All right, so today we're taking a deep dive into word embeddings, which I know could be a pretty dense topic.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially if you're prepping for a final exam on this stuff, like our listener is.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a lot to take in.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. But that's what we're here for. We're going to
Exactly.
break it all down, make it crystal clear and give you those key insights so you can totally ace this exam.
Absolutely.
Now, to help us navigate this fascinating but complex world, we've got our expert with us, a master at connecting the dots and making even the trickiest concepts easy to grasp.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm
Yeah.
excited to be here. And yeah, word embeddings are super interesting, so I'm happy to dive in.
Okay, great. So let's start with the foundation,
Okay.
lexical semantics.
Yeah.
This is all about understanding word meaning, which,
Yeah.
might seem kind of obvious at first.
Yeah, you would think
But trust me,
it's more complicated than it sounds.
it gets surprisingly complicated.
Yes.
So where should we even begin with this?
Well, I mean, I think a good place to start is by acknowledging that words are kind of slippery things, you know?
Yeah,
They can be tricky.
they can.
For example, think about the word bank.
Okay.
Are we talking about a financial institution
Right.
or the edge of a river?
Right.
That's policy me right there. One
Blah.
word with multiple meanings.
Blah.
And that's just one example of the challenges that computers face when they're trying to understand human language.
I can see how that would be a problem for my virtual assistant too.
Oh, absolutely.
Because like sometimes I'll ask it for my bank balance and it gives me the weather for Bank of America.
Exactly. Yeah,
Right.
that's policy me in action, and it's a big one,
Yeah.
but it's definitely not the only challenge.
Yep.
We also have things like lemmas, which are the dictionary forms of words, you know,
Okay.
versus word forms, which are the inflected versions that we actually use in sentences, so like run versus running.
That's right.
And then there's synonymy words with similar meanings like couch and sofa.
Right.
And kind of a basic principle in linguistics is that differences in form usually signal differences in meaning.
So even though words might seem interchangeable like an everyday conversation,
Yeah.
there are often these subtle shades of meaning that set them apart.
Exactly. And speaking of subtle differences, we've also got the distinction between word similarity and word relatedness.
Okay, so how do we tease those apart?
Well, similar words share characteristics.
Okay.
So like cat and dog, they're both furry, four-legged animals.
Gotcha.
Related words, on the other hand, might just co-occur in specific contexts,
Okay.
like coffee and cup.
Right, they tend to show up in the same scenarios.
Exactly.
Okay, I'm starting to see how
Yeah.
these basic concepts kind of build upon each other.
Absolutely.
But how does this all relate to computers actually processing language?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Well, one way to think about it is through the concept of semantic fields.
Okay.
These are sets of words that cover a particular domain, like all the words associated with a hospital. So, you know, doctor, nurse, patient,
You're
surgery.
talking like a specialized
Yeah,
vocabulary.
exactly. Yeah, like a mini vocabulary for a specific topic.
That makes me think of topic models,
Oh, yeah,
which
absolutely.
I think we'll get to a bit
We
later.
will definitely, we will.
Okay, so
Yeah.
semantic fields we've got.
Yeah.
Then we have semantic frames.
Yes.
What are those all about?
So semantic frames highlight the roles that words play within specific events.
Okay.
So think about a simple commercial transaction.
Okay.
You have a buyer, a seller, goods, and money.
Right.
Each word takes on a specific role within that frame.
So it's not just about individual words, but about how they relate to each other in
Yeah.
these larger scenarios.
Precisely, yeah. And this understanding of relationships is crucial for tasks like paraphrasing. For
Okay.
example, Sam bought a book from Ling,
Right.
can be rephrased as Ling sold a book to Sam
Right.
because we understand the underlying roles of buyer and seller within that commercial transaction frame.
Okay, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
It's like we're starting to teach computers to think about language
Right. Right.
more like humans do.
Yeah, more holistically.
But wait, we're not done with lexical semantics yet, are we?
No, not quite.
Because words aren't just cold,
Yeah.
hard facts, right?
Yeah.
They carry emotions too.
Absolutely. Words have connotations
Yeah.
or effective meanings, which play a huge role in tasks like sentiment analysis.
Right.
So, you know, wonderful and dreary might describe similar things,
Yeah.
but their emotional impact is completely different.
Totally. And this is where Osgood's work comes in, right? He was
Exactly.
all about measuring those emotional
He
vibes.
was, yeah. So Osgood proposed three dimensions of effective meaning.
Okay.
Valence. how pleasant or unpleasant a word is, arousal, the intensity of the emotion and dominance, the degree of control associated with the word.
Okay, so happy would be high on valence.
Yes.
Excited
yeah.
would be high on arousal, and powerful would be high on dominance.
Exactly. You got it.
Okay.
And here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay.
Osgood realized that by representing words with these three values, you could essentially plot them as points in a three-dimensional space.
Okay.
Each word becomes a vector, like a coordinate on a map.
Hold on. So you're telling me that words can be represented mathematically as vectors?
I am.
That seems like a huge leap.
It is a huge leap, and that is the foundation of vector semantics, which takes us one step closer to the world of word embeddings.
Okay. I'm officially intrigued.
Right.
Let's dive into this vector world.
Let's do it. Okay, so we've talked about how words can be represented as vectors.
Right, these mathematical points in space.
Exactly, but how do we actually build those vectors?
Yeah, that's the question.
And it all starts with this idea of co-occurrence.
Co-occurrence.
Yeah, basically words that frequently appear together. They're likely to be related in some way.
That makes sense.
Right, and to track these co-occurrences, we use something called a co-occurrence matrix.
A matrix? Okay, that sounds a little intimidating.
It sounds more complicated than it is.
Okay, good.
Basically, imagine a giant spreadsheet.
Okay.
And in one type of co-occurrence matrix called a term document matrix.
A PAR document.
Each row represents a word, and each column represents a document.
Hey.
And each cell in the matrix tells you how many times that word appears in that specific document.
So if we're looking at a collection of, like, news articles,
yeah,
we'd have a row for election and a column for each article.
Exactly.
And the cell would show us how many times election appears in each article.
Precisely. And that's how we can represent each document as a vector.
Okay.
Yeah, basically a list of numbers that corresponds to the word counts for that document.
So documents about similar topics would have similar vectors?
Right.
Because they'd have similar word distributions.
Exactly.
That's kind of how search engines work, right?
It is. Yeah. They compare your search query to those document vectors to find the most relevant results.
To find the best match.
Exactly. Yeah. And here's the cool part.
Okay.
We can also use the term document matrix to represent words as vectors.
Okay. How does that work?
So each row, which represents a word, becomes a vector with each dimension corresponding to a different document.
So the election vector would tell us how often it appears in each news article.
Exactly.
And we can compare these vectors to find similar words.
Yes.
Like maybe campaign and voting would have similar vectors to election.
Exactly, because they tend to appear in the same documents.
Right.
But there's another type of co-occurrence matrix that we use.
Okay, what's that one?
It's called a term-term matrix.
Term-term.
And instead of documents, the columns represent context words.
Context words.
Yeah, so we look at a window of words around our target word and count how often each context word appears within that window.
So if my target word is coffee, I'd look at the words that appear near it, like cup, cream, sugar, morning.
Exactly.
And count how many times each of those words shows up near coffee.
Precisely. And this gives us a vector for each word based on its context, words.
Okay. And words that appear in similar contexts will have similar vectors.
Exactly. Yeah. So coffee and tea might have similar vectors.
Because they're often found near words like drink, hot, caffeine.
Exactly. Yeah. You got it.
Okay. So we've got these co-occurrence matrices that give us vectors for both words and documents.
Uh-huh.
But we're still just dealing with raw counts, right?
Right.
Isn't that a bit too simplistic?
Yeah, you're sharp. You're picking up on that. Yeah, raw frequencies can be problematic.
Okay, in what way?
Well, think about words like the or an.
Right.
They appear everywhere.
Yeah.
They don't tell us much about specific word relationships.
So we need a way to kind of weight those counts.
Exactly. Yeah. Give more importance to the meaningful associations.
Filter out the noise and amplify the signal.
I like that analogy. Yeah. So for term document matrices, a popular weighting scheme is called TFIDF.
TFIDF.
Which stands for Term Frequency Inverse Document Frequency.
Okay. Bit of a mouthful.
It is a mouthful, but the idea is pretty intuitive.
All right. Let's break it down.
Okay.
What's TF all about?
So term frequency, or TF, just measures how frequently a word appears in a document.
Okay.
We can use the raw count or apply like a logarithmic scaling to kind of dampen the effect of extremely frequent words.
So a word that appears 100 times isn't necessarily 100 times more important than a word that appears once.
Exactly.
It's about finding a balance.
Right. And then inverse document frequency, or IDF.
IDF.
That comes in to address the issue of those common, not so informative words.
Okay.
So it gives higher weight to words that are rare across the entire set of documents.
So a word like algorithm would have a high IDF.
Yes.
Because it only appears in documents related to computer science.
Right.
Whereas the poll would have a low IDF.
Very low.
Because it's everywhere.
Exactly, yeah. And by multiplying TF and IDF,
okay,
we get a weight that balances frequency within a document with rarity across the entire document collection.
So it helps us zero in on the words that really define a document's meaning.
Precisely, yeah. Like a spotlight, yeah, highlighting the keywords.
TF, IDF is a spotlight.
I like that.
I like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's for term document matrices?
Uh-huh.
What about term matrices? We have a special weighting scheme for those.
We do. It's called PPMI, or positive point-wise mutual information.
PPMI.
And PPMI tells us how much more often two words co-occur than we would expect if they were totally independent.
Okay, can you give me an example?
Sure. So imagine we're looking at the words peanut and butter.
Okay, classic combo.
Right. They appear together a lot.
Yeah.
So PPMI measures how much more often they co-occur than we would expect if they had no relationship at all.
Okay, so if peanut and butter are practically inseparable,
yeah,
they'll have a high PPMI.
Very high.
But if they only appeared together randomly, their PPMI would be low.
Exactly. And PPMI addresses some of the issues with regular PMI, which can have negative values.
Okay.
Which are hard to interpret.
Right.
PPMI just sets those negative values to zero.
Okay.
Focusing on the positive association.
Gotcha. So now we've got these weighted vectors for both words and documents.
Yeah.
Thanks to TF.
They are. Yeah.
What about word similarity?
Yeah.
How can we use these vectors to find synonyms or related words?
We can use cosine similarity again, but this time to compare word vectors directly.
Okay.
So by finding the words with the highest cosine similarity to our target word, we can identify its closest semantic neighbors.
So if I want to find synonyms for happy, I can look for words whose vectors are closest to the happy vector.
Exactly. Yeah. And this has applications in paraphrasing, machine translation, even historical linguistics.
Okay.
Where you can track how the meanings of words have shifted over time.
That's so cool.
It is.
We've gone from basic word meanings to sophisticated mathematical models.
Yeah.
That can represent those meanings and help us find relationships between words.
And that brings us to dense embeddings.
Dense embeddings. Okay. I have a feeling this is where things get really mind blowing.
You're right, it is.
All right, so dense embeddings, this is the big leagues.
It is, yeah, it's where things get really exciting.
Okay, so tell me, what are dense embeddings and why are they so special?
Well, dense embeddings are basically like the secret weapon of modern NLP. They're short, usually only a few hundred dimensions.
Okay.
And they're packed with real valued numbers, both positive and negative.
So no more sparsity here.
No more sparsity. These are dense vectors.
Dense vectors. Okay, so what makes them so powerful?
Well, for one thing, they're much more compact.
Okay.
Which makes them way easier to work with computationally.
Right.
Imagine training a machine learning model with a 50,000 dimensional sparse vector.
Yeah.
Versus a 300 dimensional dense vector.
That's a huge difference.
Huge difference in terms of complexity.
Okay, so dense embeddings are like the streamlined sports car.
Yeah.
Of word representation.
I like that analogy.
Nimble and efficient.
Exactly.
But what about capturing meaning? Do they do a better job of representing those subtle relationships between words?
Absolutely. Yeah, one of their biggest strengths is capturing synonymy.
Okay.
Remember how sparse vectors treated synonyms like car and automobile as completely separate dimensions?
Yeah, it seemed like a missed opportunity.
It was, yeah. Dense embeddings can overcome that limitation.
Okay.
Words with similar meanings will have similar vectors, even if they don't frequently appear together in text.
So it's like they're able to learn a more abstract underlying representation of meaning?
Exactly. Yeah, they're getting at something deeper.
That's fascinating. Okay, so how do we actually create these magical dense embeddings?
Well, one of the most popular methods is an algorithm called Word2Vec.
Word2Vec. Okay.
And specifically, we'll focus on the SkipGram with negative sampling model, or SGNS for short.
SGNS.
It's a bit of a mouthful.
It is.
But the idea is actually pretty clever.
Okay, I'm all ears. Walk me through this SkipGram dance.
All right, so imagine we're looking at a sentence, and we pick a target word, let's say king.
Okay, king.
The skipgram model tries to predict the words that are likely to appear near king.
Okay, so words like queen, castle, ruler.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe even Shakespeare if we're talking about literature.
Right.
So it's like a word guessing game, using context clues to figure out which words belong together.
I like it.
Yeah, and we can frame this as a binary classification problem.
Yeah.
Positive examples are words that actually appear near king.
Okay.
And negative examples are random words from our vocabulary.
So we're training a classifier to distinguish between real context words and random noise words. But
Exactly.
how does this lead to those dense embeddings?
Ah, well, here's the key. The algorithm learns weights during this training process,
Okay.
and those weights become our word embeddings.
So the embeddings are a byproduct of this.
Yeah, they emerge from the training process.
That's pretty cool.
And the best part is we're not hand labeling any data.
Okay.
The text itself provides the training
So
examples.
it's a form of self-supervision.
Exactly, yeah. Self-supervision, the embeddings are teaching themselves.
That is mind-blowing. Okay, but how does the algorithm actually learn those weights?
So it's all about pushing related words closer together in the embedding space
Okay.
and pulling unrelated words farther apart. The algorithm looks at the target word and its surrounding context, constantly adjusting the embeddings to maximize similarity between the target and its actual neighbors,
Okay.
while minimizing similarity to those random noise words.
So it's like a delicate
It
dance,
is, yeah.
fine-tuning the positions of all these words in this multidimensional vector space.
Precisely.
Okay. And how do we measure similarity in this space?
So we use the dot product.
Dot product.
Yeah, the higher the dot product, the more similar the words.
Okay.
And then we apply the sigmoid function to get a probability score.
Ah, the sigmoid function.
Our old friend.
Right back again.
It squishes the output between 0 and 1.
So it's amazing how these fundamental machine learning concepts all come together
They do,
in these
yeah.
really creative ways.
It's a beautiful thing.
But hold on. You said that Word2Vec learns two embeddings per word.
I did, yeah.
What's that all about?
So it learns both a target embedding and a context embedding.
Okay.
You can think of them as two sides of the same coin, representing the word's role as both the focus and the background.
So we get a richer, more nuanced view of the word's meaning by considering both perspectives.
Exactly.
That's pretty neat. Are there other ways to create dense embeddings besides Word2Vec?
Yeah, definitely. There's fast text,
Fast text.
which breaks down words into smaller units, like character engrams.
Character engrams.
Yeah, basically sequences of characters.
Okay.
This helps handle unknown words, even those the model hasn't seen before.
So even if a word is brand new, we can still generate a reasonable embedding for it
Exactly.
based on its subword parts.
Yeah, based on its components.
That's super helpful.
It is, and then there's GLOVE,
Glove.
which stands for Global Vectors for Word Representation.
Global vectors.
And GLOVE kind of combines the best of both worlds.
Okay.
It leverages global corpus statistics like PPMI, while also capturing those linear structures that Word2Vec excels at.
So Glove is like the diplomat,
Yeah.
bringing together different approaches for a harmonious embedding space.
I like that. Very diplomatic.
Okay, so once we've got these dense embeddings, how do we actually visualize and understand them?
Right, because they're still living in this high-dimensional vector world.
Exactly.
Yeah, so a simple approach is to just list the most similar words to a target word
Okay.
based on cosine similarity.
All right.
We can also use dimensionality reduction techniques like TSNE
Okay.
to project those high-dimensional vectors onto a 2D plane for visualization.
So we can create those cool scatter plots where similar words cluster together.
Exactly. Yeah, like constellations in the embedding space.
I love those.
They're very helpful.
They really help make sense of things. But what about the semantic properties of these embeddings? What
Yeah.
kind of relationships can they capture beyond just similarity?
Right, so context window size plays a big role here.
Okay.
Short windows tend to capture more syntactic similarity.
Syntactic similarity.
Yeah, words that appear in similar grammatical structures,
Okay.
like verbs with similar conjugation patterns.
So wrote might be close to said.
Exactly, yeah, because they're both past tense verbs that often appear in similar positions in a sentence.
Gotcha.
Longer windows, on the other hand, capture more topical similarity,
Love them.
bringing together words that are thematically related.
So if we're talking about Harry Potter, Hogwarts might be close to Dumbledore, magic, wand. and potion.
Exactly. Yeah. If we're using a longer context window.
All right.
And here's another really interesting thing.
Yeah.
Dense embeddings can actually capture relational similarity using something called the parallelogram model.
The parallelogram model.
Yeah. And with this, we can actually solve analogy problems using vector arithmetic.
Wait, really? So we can do that classic king man plus woman queen analogy
Exactly.
using vectors?
Using vectors, yeah.
That's incredible.
It shows that embeddings are learning something deeper than just co-occurrence patterns.
Right.
They're starting to encode those underlying relationships between words like the concept of gender or royalty.
So we're getting close to giving computers a real understanding of human language.
It's a very exciting time for NLP.
It is. Okay, so as we wrap things up, are there any caveats or things we should keep in mind when working with dense embeddings?
Yeah. Definitely. It's crucial to remember that embeddings are trained on real-world texts,
Right.
which inevitably reflects human biases,
Of
and
course.
these biases can get embedded in the vector space,
Okay.
leading to unfair or discriminatory outcomes if we're not careful.
So we need to be aware of these potential biases and actively work to mitigate them.
Absolutely. We don't want our algorithms perpetuating harmful stereotypes.
Right. Well, this has been an incredible deep dive.
It has.
We've covered so much ground, from the basic building blocks of lexical semantics all the way to these sophisticated dense embeddings.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey.
And to our listener, good luck with that final exam.
Yes, good luck.
We're confident you'll ace it after this deep dive. And if you come across any other intriguing NLP topics, you know where to find us.
Absolutely, we're always up for another deep dive.
Until then, happy exploring.
Happy exploring. I'm